I don't know if I've ever seen a case like this. Cases of serial arson are rare. I don't even think there's been a similar case since the 50s.
What makes this case different?
The scale, for one. There's just so much destruction. But other than that, motive. Even after the arrest, after all their evidence, they still have no real motive. Juries like to be told a story. No matter how much stacks up against him, people will naturally get stuck on the question of why.
Why do you think he did it?
My only guess? He's just evil.
In 2 weeks, Blake Kennedy will face trial for 5 counts of arson and 6 counts of murder. All of New York State has been waiting with pitchforks in hand to see the results of the long-drawn-out manhunt for the Mohawk Valley arsonist. Since his arrest, I have been digging deep into the case against Kennedy. What exactly he's accused of, what led to his arrest, and who he is. From Hudson Today and WNEC, I'm Jordan Everett, and this is Flashover. For the benefit of the listeners, will you explain a little about the motives for arson?
Sure. With arson, you have a simple list of motives to choose from.
The voice you're hearing is Walter Morris, a graduate of Albany Law School who does legal coverage for Hudson Today. I've asked for his insight into how the Kennedy trial will proceed.
Fraud, revenge, pyromania, vandalism, and concealment of a crime. The one prosecution has to lean towards when there's no evidence of the other four, especially in a serial arson case, has to be pyromania. But they have very little to go off on that. The defense is practically begging for prosecution to lean into that because they always have a laundry list of ways to counter it.
Do you believe it's pyromania?
It doesn't matter what you or I believe. It matters what the jury will believe.
Walter is not at all worried about how the court will prove the where, when, what, who, or how of the case. Only the why. And he's right to be. When Walter says that the jury needs a story, he knows what he's talking about. If prosecution can't put together all the details, every piece, into a convincing narrative, it's all going to fall apart. But let's back up a bit and let me fill you in on the rest of the case. Before we can talk about the motive, I'm going to simply lay out the details of what has been going on in the Mohawk Valley for the past few years. Although there are additional unconfirmed fires that some also blame Kennedy for, I'll just be speaking on the ones he's officially charged with, starting with the fires that made the pattern appear. The first fire on the list of charges is the Lindsay Street fire. 32 Lindsay Street had been in Leota, New York for as long as the rest of the neighborhood, which was built in 1942 as part of the redevelopment program for the area. The houses were put together quickly and cheaply, and were known to have a lot of problems. I spoke to other residents in the area, who all reported issues with the pipes not running, bursting, or turning the water strange colors. None of the houses are well insulated, and the temperature inside is typically harsher than outside. Many also have water damage causing the lower floors to buckle. 32 Lindsay is part of a section of the street that was bought out by a landlord and split into duplex and triplex rentals. The first and third floor of 32 Lindsay was home to 2 families, and the middle floor was occupied by a group of college students. On November 12th, just after 7 p.m., the 10-year-old daughter of Rachel and Marcus Goodman, living on the third floor, was the first to smell smoke. She told the fire department that it smelled similarly to when something fell on the bottom of the oven while her mother was cooking, so she wasn't alarmed. Later, her father and mother reported thinking similarly, since they assumed someone on a lower floor had burnt whatever they were making for dinner. After 20 minutes, the young girl complained to her parents that her eyes were stinging. There was a considerable amount of smoke in the apartment. The family were all upset, but they didn't want to bother either of their neighbors, so they opened up all the windows in the apartment and just hoped things would settle down. At this point, the students just below them had begun to really notice the smell.
Nothing really felt out of the ordinary, honestly.
That's Roxy Walker. She and 2 of her classmates, Kristen Boyd and Herbert McKinney, were living on the second floor of 32 Lindsay during the fire.
You aren't alarmed?
I mean, yeah, it didn't seem normal, but we didn't immediately jump into the whole place is on fire, you know? We assumed they had really fucked up their oven. It was annoying after a bit, though. It just smelled really, really awful, and we were like, why the hell aren't they dealing with this? But we didn't want to start something.
The three students had only moved in earlier that month and didn't know their neighbors very well.
How long did you wait?
Had to have been at least 20 minutes. We really didn't want to confront them and fight about it. Every time I think about it, I just want to yell at my past self like in a horror movie, you know? Get out of there, you idiot! I'm just happy Mrs. Goodman was smarter than us.
At 8 o'clock, Mrs. Goodman finally decided it was too much. She went down the stairs, prepared to bang down the door of the Sandovals on the first floor. As she descended, she started to feel the heat from under the steps. When she got to their door, she saw a light behind the windows that she described as way brighter than it should have been. It even shined through the cracks in the wood paneling and around the edges of the door. Thick smoke was pouring out of the mail slot and up the side of the house, leaving a sooty stain. She immediately rushed back inside to pull her family out.
Mr. Goodman practically broke down our door. He was screaming, "Get out, get out, get out!" And that's when we all knew. People always talk about what they grabbed in a fire. But when you're in the moment, it's really hard to think straight. All I managed was my phone and this one stuffed koala that I've had since I was a kid. I completely forgot to grab my laptop, my wallet. I never even put on shoes. We were all so panicked, we just ran.
Who called the fire department?
Christy and Herb tried to be a hero and break into the first floor for some rescue mission. All he managed to do was burn all the hair off of his left arm. He still can't really grow arm hair right anymore.
Then there was another fire. 130 Piccadilly Road was a duplex in Millport, in a similarly struggling neighborhood. But outside that, the two homes had very little in common. Except 2 weeks after the Lindsay Street fire, 130 Piccadilly became a tower of black smoke. Once again, the fire was caused by accelerant poured through the mail slot while the downstairs tenants weren't home. 911 was called by a neighbor, but something interesting happened on that call. Piccadilly Road is in a different district from Lindsay Street, and would therefore have gotten a response from the Millport Fire Department. However, due to the raging wildfire in the Stone Peaks Forest that weekend that pulled nearby fire departments in for backup, operators redirected the fire to the Leodor Fire Department instead. I spoke to the captain, Andre Hopkins, and he said he instantly recognized the elements from the 32 Lindsay fire.
The mail slot, the deliberate targeting of a multifamily household, specifically while one family was away. Even the ignition was the same.
The arsonist used the same fire starter consisting of a cigarette and matches in both fires.
You knew instantly it was the same person?
Right away. Not a doubt in my mind.
The department had to confront the harsh reality of a serial arsonist. Andre called a meeting in which the New York fire departments pulled evidence from outstanding cases. They found out they had 17 fires caused by similar methods over the last 12 months. Three of these had resulted in death for one or more of the residents. An horrific pattern had made itself clear.
It was terrifying. And it was happening right under our noses. We knew there had to be some connection we could put together, but people were still dying, and no one but us had any idea what was happening.
Do you regret going public with what you found out?
Sometimes, seeing the fear, we got a lot more calls for false alarms, and that made it harder for us. But I have to believe we saved lives by telling people to be aware of what was going on. We don't really work like police. Our job isn't about catching bad guys. It's just about saving the most lives possible. I believe that's what we did.
And many lives were saved. The awareness of the public was a very useful tool in reducing the victims of this string of crimes. Teams from the station were requested in many schools and libraries to give fire safety presentations. There was a 45% increase in the amount of homes that had some kind of camera installed by their doors. But the state's resources began to be stretched thinner and thinner as more calls started to come in for false alarms, bad leads, and general panic. Regretfully, despite the knowledge of the general public, not everyone could be saved. And Blake Kennedy's victim count grew. That's next time on Flashover.
Flashover was written and directed by Cleo Thayer. Hello, that's me. If you would like to see updates on this project or any of my upcoming work, you can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Cleo Thayer. That's at CLIOTHAYER. The theme music for Flashover was made by Scotty Rich, whose other work you can find on Twitter at Scotty_Rich. In this episode, you heard S.J. Lindsay as Jordan Everett, Jacob Brown as Walter Morris, Marissa Marino as Roxy Walker, and Brandon Cable as Andre Hopkins. Big thanks to WNEC, the New England College radio station, for allowing us to use their space to record. They can be found at WNECFM.org, or you can tune in to 91.7 if you're in the New Hampshire area. Any names, locations, and events in Flashover are fictional, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, or real events is entirely coincidental. And if I pull a Simpsons, I'm deeply sorry. This episode is dedicated to my father, who inspired and nurtured me as a writer, as well as listeners like you who stick around. Thank you.